Readings from Mark chapter 10, verse 35 to 45, and it's on the sheets. And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came up to him and said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." And he said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Grant us to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left, in your glory." Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized?" And they said to him, "We are able." And Jesus said to them, "The cup that I drink, you will drink, and with the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand or my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared." And when the ten heard it, they began to be indignant at James and John. And Jesus said to them, Jesus called them to him and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever must be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many."
In a letter to Miss Lydia Bixby, a mother whose son died in the American Civil War in 1864, Abraham Lincoln wrote, "I pray that our Heavenly Father may assuage the anguish of your bereavement and leave only the cherished memory of the loved and lost and the solemn pride that must be yours to have laid so costly a sacrifice upon the altar of freedom." Throughout history, our leaders have recognised the need to commemorate the sacrifice made by soldiers and their families in the service of their country. And throughout the Christian world, they turn to religious institutions for the imagery and ideas that can help lend meaning to that sacrifice. And so here we are, in a Christian church, remembering the sacrifice of those who have given their lives in service of this nation. It's a wonderfully simple act. 2 minutes of quiet reflection. A very rare thing indeed in our modern world, especially, I suspect, here in the heart of the city. But what exactly should we be remembering and why? Perhaps some of you have served, I know some of you have served in the military. Perhaps many of you have friends and family who have been involved in the current conflict in Afghanistan. But for most of you, I guess that's not the case. Maybe in those 2 minutes, you visualise young men staring back at you from sepia images of First World War trenches. Maybe you try and remember the stories that your parents or grandparents told you about their experiences of the Second World War. But if you're anything like me, you find it's not all that straightforward. For one thing, 2 minutes turns out to be a really, really long time. William asked me along this morning to provide you with a serviceman's perspective on remembrance. And I thought I'd just try and sum up my reflections based on some of my recent experiences. Last year, I was approaching the end of a 12-month tour in Afghanistan, and my thoughts in relation to our remembrance seemed very much more immediate and profound. Even in the relative safety of a large headquarters in Kabul, we'd suffered a series of meaningful attacks on the base, and suicide and vehicle bombs were proving particularly lethal as we tried to move around the city. Several of our friends had been killed by their Afghan colleagues while working in Afghan ministries. Two Americans that I worked and lived with shot in the back of the head at point-blank range while working at their desks, doing nothing more than helping a war-torn country to get back on its feet. Men much like you and me, really, with young families, full of life when you had breakfast with them in the morning, but not there anymore at dinner time. That almost intangible sense of safety that we enjoy for most of our normal lives was well and truly shattered. As casualties grew, we started to hold weekly remembrance services standing outside in the snow of an Afghan winter, remembering friends who had paid a very high price indeed. So following a military theme, and in the absence of anything more elegant, I thought I'd use what we call the five W's to corral my thoughts. Who, what, why, where, and when. We're always taught that when writing orders of any kind or plans, as long as you cover the five W's, you won't go too far wrong. And for Remembrance Sunday, the when is pretty straightforward, isn't it? The armistice, marking the formal end of hostilities for World War I, was signed at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. And so each year at 11 o'clock or thereabouts, on the 11th of November, we pause to remember. So, moving on to the what we remember. Well, the phrase we most often hear on these occasions is those who make the ultimate sacrifice, those who die for their country. And the numbers making that sacrifice in Afghanistan are still growing. Since we sent the military there in the wake of the attacks on New York in 2001, 446 members of the British Armed Forces have died. So on Remembrance, thinking about their sacrifice reminds us that life is very fragile indeed. And in itself, that's quite unusual, isn't it? The more I've thought about this over the last couple of weeks, the more I realise how countercultural death has become. I don't know if things are any different here in the cosmopolitan surroundings of London, but out in the provinces, it seems to me that the only remaining taboo of the middle-class dinner party is talk of death. It's remarkable, really, as it's the only thing we'll all have in common one day. But our modern world is so full of things that distract us from this harsh reality, things that hold our minds in the relative here and now, a here and now that for the most part feels pretty safe. Our cars feel safe, planes rarely fall out of the sky, and medicine offers seemingly endless hope for a longer and a better life. What's more, we're encouraged to grasp life, to live every moment, to choose what we want and make it happen. It's as if we're in control. It's as if we're invulnerable or immortal. Nothing about this sort of cultural narrative seems to help us very much in dealing with death. And so as we pause to remember those in our armed services who willingly face danger, those who make the ultimate sacrifice, we're reminded of our own mortality, reminded that one day we'll all have to face death. But it's not just death and the dead that we should remember. There are also those heroic individuals who inspire us with the tales they live to tell. And I'd say that the dead and our heroes are just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to military sacrifice. Even in Afghanistan, fear for your life, concern for your personal safety, is not the overwhelming sacrifice for the vast majority of our servicemen and women. Free time, comfort and personal choice are the first casualties of most wars. But separation from friends and family are often the most profound. And so we can't remember the sacrifices of our military without remembering those of their families. The worry they feel, the love they miss, and for those left alone with children, the plain hard work of life as a single parent. And that brings us to the who. I take it if we're going to remember the heroes of today's military, we'll need to know something about them. Who are they? What are they like? And what do they do? So just let me tell you briefly about two that I've had the pleasure of meeting. The first is a Royal Marine Reservist from the unit in Bristol near where I live. His name is Matt Croucher. And while he was part of a small recce team patrolling around Sangin, he felt a tripwire against his leg and saw that he'd activated a booby trap connected to a grenade. What did he do? Well, what would you or I do in the 7 seconds that he had to act while waiting for the explosion that would bring death or serious injury to him and the 4 other people in his team? Well, all Matt could think of was how he could protect his team. And so he threw himself backwards on top of the grenade to smother the blast with his rucksack and his body armour. Incredibly, he survived and he was awarded the George Cross. The second hero you might want to remember is a fantastic young lady called Kate Nisbet. She's 5 foot nothing, and when she volunteered to go to Afghanistan, she was 20 years old. Her platoon was caught in a firefight, and one of the soldiers with her was shot through the neck and jaw at the front of the patrol. Under heavy fire, Kate ran 70 metres across open ground to treat the casualty. In the middle of what even battle-hardened NCOs called an intense firefight, she worked on that casualty for 45 minutes, repeatedly having to stand up in relatively open ground to make sure that the IV drip was doing its work. The soldier shouted at her to stay down as the bullets and RPGs whistled all around. But she did what she knew she had to save that young soldier's life. She was awarded the Military Cross for outstanding bravery. At the turn of this century, academics and commentators wasted countless column inches worrying about how young men and women of what they called the Xbox generation would fight. Well, acts of heroism like these in Afghanistan and Iraq have allayed any concerns, and we would do well to spend some of our 2 minutes thinking about those young men and women. Not to be cowed by the remarkable things that they've done, because if Matt and Kate were sitting here today, the only thing that would strike you about them is how unremarkable they both are. Rather, their feats should be an inspiration to us to push through with whatever trials life throws up and to take perhaps a more self-sacrificial view of what it is we're doing here on Earth, how we use our time, our attitudes around us. So enough of the when, the what and the who. What about the why? Why do we remember? For me, the answer lies back with the word sacrifice. Even for those like me whose reasons for joining up were, if I'm honest, dominated by nothing more sinister than a large gin and tonic at various exotic parts of the world, there comes a time in the lives of most soldiers, sailors, and airmen when they want to, even need to, believe that the sacrifices that they have made and their families have made were in some way worthwhile, some way for the greater good. And that can be a real problem for those fighting in recent wars. Unlike the wars that our grandparents were involved in, conflicts of recent years have been fought on the basis of political choice rather than national survival. What's worse, these political choices have been far from universally popular. We've been in Afghanistan longer than we fought the Second World War. And whatever enthusiasm a war-weary and suspicious British public had left after the invasion of Iraq has ebbed away fast. Add to that the fact that recent wars have been fought in faraway lands, difficult for us to understand or even conceive of, and that our modern culture has so little to say about sacrifice and self-service. And we run the risk that the British public is unable to give our servicemen and women that sense of worth that they desire. And so people like you, coming to remembrance services like this, buying and wearing poppies, giving money to charities like Care for Casualties, these are all absolutely crucial ways in which we can recognise the sacrifices that servicemen and women and their families have made. Long after our forces return from Afghanistan next year, and that all that is being done and has been done starts to fade from our public consciousness, thousands will still carry the physical and mental scars of what they've endured in Helmand, in Iraq, in Northern Ireland, the Falklands. The list goes on. And we owe them a debt that will last for a generation. Our remembrance, our recognition of their sacrifice, our giving must last for that generation too. It will be crucial in helping their well-being and upholding that deal, what we call the military covenant, that a democracy has with its military men and women. And we're on the home straight now, just the where to cover. And it doesn't matter, does it? As long as we're remembering, as long as we're upholding our end of that deal, location is surely irrelevant, you might say. And to some extent, I think you're right. But we have all chosen today to come to a church for our act of remembrance. I know plenty of soldiers, and I know lots of Christians, and the links aren't always necessarily all that obvious. So why do we remember in a church? Perhaps it's our middle-class Britishness, just the way we've been brought up. Maybe it just feels right. A couple of years ago, I was caught in Tesco for the two-minute silence, and as pleased as I was that they'd chosen to mark remembrance, concentrating on matters profound in the frozen food section was way, way beyond me. I think there's more to the link with church than just decor and ambiance. While our society may have little to say about death and sacrifice, the death of Jesus Christ, God's own Son, is at the heart of the Christian faith. While the rest of the world gives us little help in dealing with death, our God sent his Son to rescue us from it by sacrificing his own life as a ransom, a rescue. And that rescue brings with it hope. Not just hope of a full life or even a safe life, but hope of life after death. In the Bible passage that Karen read for us earlier, James and John, two of Jesus' disciples, have cast aside their simple background as fishermen and seem to be bidding for some sort of celestial celebrity, asking to sit at Jesus' left and right side in heaven. In the midst of some understandable concern among the other disciples, Jesus calls them together in verse 43 and says, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to serve, but to be served, did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." And so the death at the heart of Christianity is not the sacrifice of a mother's young son on the altar of freedom, as Abraham Lincoln wrote in the letter I read at the beginning. It's not the death of a religious fanatic with a suicide bomb strapped to his chest. The death at the heart of Christianity is of God's Son as a sacrifice for us, a ransom for our sin, for all that we got and get wrong. And his resurrection brings hope, hope of a life after death, a hope that servicemen and women and their families and Christians throughout the world have clung to throughout history. And so what might we remember in these 2 minutes of quiet? Well, I take it we'll remember those who made the ultimate sacrifice. We'll remember the modern-day heroism of young men and women like Matt and Kate. And remember, too, the altogether more mundane sacrifice of thousands of British military and their families who make so many sacrifices in our name. And finally, remember why we came to a Christian church for our 2 minute silence. Remember that we have a God who knows what it is to lose a son, who understands the pain and sacrifice of the military and their families, and who understands that sacrifice needs to be purposeful to offer hope. Not just the hope of a country rebuilt, a death remembered, but hope for life after death, a better life. Christ's sacrifice had real purpose to bring us resurrection. Resurrection which can bring real comfort for the bereaved, hope for the families of those we've lost to war and conflict.
The Bible closes with a description of the new world that God has prepared under the rule of the Lord Jesus Christ as a result of his death and resurrection. Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away.